Hello, and welcome to Geography Arcade, a podcast about the intersection of geography and video games. My name is Dave Chaffins, and this week we'll be talking about Home Place and Fallout 76. I wanted to start with Fallout 76 because it is indeed about where I live. I remember watching the teaser trailer back a few years ago and hearing the song Country Roads, and I couldn't quite familiarize myself with where it would be. I guess Country Roads is a great clue, but I don't expect anything to come to West Virginia in general. When I watched the E3 trailer for it, I recognized a bunch of the different locations, like the New River Gorge, the Capitol Building, and so on. I felt kind of partial to this game because of my background and my study. So to start with my background, I was born technically in West Virginia. I grew up in this town called Bluefield, which essentially is split by a state line. So Bluefield, West Virginia is a city, and it's a larger town on the West Virginia side. And then right down the middle is the state line, and I live on the Virginia side. That's where I've lived growing up. I had the same kind of idea about hometowns that most kids would have. I really didn't think anything of it. And then when I got into high school, I really just kind of wanted to leave my hometown and move on to other things. But my family has a lot of history, both in West Virginia and Virginia, but all together in Appalachia. My parents, particularly my dad, grew up in Welch, kind of towards the end of the coal mining boom that happened. He also would talk to me about when he was 16 working in the coal mine, not necessarily in the mine itself, but in the part shop. I think he would go over and help out some. My mother comes from southwestern Virginia, which is Wise County, and has a deep family history there that goes back generations and generations to a theorized people called the Melungeons, which are kind of a multicultural group that lived in Appalachia that had some persecution back in the day, mainly because they were mixed race. When I got to college, I wanted to originally be a chemist, but like all people that I think have an idea that they start with in college, unless they're really driven for a dream, it doesn't particularly work out. And finally, I landed on geography. Particularly what I do now today is in cartography, but I had a real interest in some of the anthropology, the economic and social ties that geography have. There's science there, of course, but I really grew this interest in it, and I ended up minoring in this field called Appalachian Studies. What that was a refresher and a deep dive into this culture that I kind of grew up in that I had no real idea about. In college, we would study folk culture. So we were talking about some interesting things like stories and ghost tales, or as they call them, haint tales. I'm not sure how frequently you hear the word haint. There was moonshining that we learned about. We didn't learn to moonshine itself, though. I'm sure that you could probably find that if you lived here. There was a number of different facets from religion, like snake handling churches, which is a whole other world and understanding that I really didn't have. I ended up graduating and looking for work across America. I remember I applied to the total was 60 jobs right out of college. We were coming into kind of right out of an economic recession where there wasn't a lot of jobs. If anybody has graduated college and is applying for jobs, you know that most entry-level places require 5 years of experience which is a joke to me because that's not entry level whatsoever. I ended up finding a job in West Virginia in Charleston, and I had only been to Charleston as a kid for my dad would come here for teachers' conferences. So I imagined the city to be rather big, like kind of how New York is, which seems kind of crazy, but I moved here and settled down, ended up living in the suburbs for a little bit, and then moved directly into the city. When the trailers first released, the first person I talked to was my longtime friend and now neighbor who had moved in down the street from me, Austin. We talked about how excited we were for the games. We even joked back in high school and in early college that our friends group was the, quote, Brotherhood of Steel, which is rather funny because shortly after that text message, we had talked about doing a podcast, and we came up with this idea of doing a West Virginia history podcast based around the game Fallout 76. We had never done anything like this. We had just kind of thrown it together. We called it Vault Boys WV, and it had a pretty successful year and a half run. You can actually go back and listen to that podcast. There's an archive of it. I'm sure that if you search for it on iTunes, you'll be able to look it up. That chronicles our first year of playing the game. A lot of that stuff was made before the game even was out and was going off of reference of trailers, which is something that I had not done. And there was a ton of speculation that wasn't so much speculation. It was more just, here's a picture of something. We think it relates to this. Here's the history of it. And Bethesda filled the game with insider information about West Virginia, history, culture, to a level degree that I don't think a lot of multimedia gets when it comes to West Virginia. The only way that you'd be able to find something like that is through NPR. When I started thinking about home place and this intersection that it has with the game, I knew that that was going to be where I started. I actually told my wife that this would be the first episode subject, and she said, oh, you're going to talk about home place. Well, to me, home place is a small restaurant located off the Appalachian Trail where you go and get family-sized portions of green beans, potatoes, tomatoes, chicken, country fried steak, and you eat so much that you throw up in the parking lot. This was a common thing that we did when we lived in Blacksburg and went to Virginia Tech with our friends together. I don't think I've ever thrown up in the parking lot. I don't think she's ever thrown up in the parking lot, but I've certainly watched a few people throw up in the parking lot. So that's kind of what home place means to her, which is obviously not true in the anthropological sense. I was looking up quotes for what home place is, and somebody asked Robert Frost to define that, and he said, it all depends on what you mean by home. During this time, I was also talking to my wife following this story about throwing up in the parking lot of a country-style kitchen. And she found that Robert Frost was, I suppose, tiring and said, oh, Robert Frost, snow on grass, birch leaf, blah, blah, blah. Everyone overhypes Robert Frost. And so I'm going to take to that and not let him define what home place is. But home could be your house. It could be your parents' house. It could be your cozy workshop. It could be your apartment. Really, it's anywhere that gives you an emotional response of comfort, but it's not limited to that. But oftentimes we feel that. Recliners, I guess, could be, but I really would focus on not trying to be Amelia Bedelia during this and not being as literal as you can be when it comes to the subject matter. When it comes to home, I go back and look at what anthropologists have said about it. It really starts with early settlements. Settlements are so central to human development, making shelters, dwellings, and residence patterns necessary. Anthropologist Shelley Millay argues that shelter is described as simply one aspect of home. Moreover, it is generally recognized that the relationships between the terms house and home must be established in varying cultural and historical contexts. Right off the bat, I think that there's a difference between how we utilized home and house. We buy a house. We live in a home. We enter someone's home. We look at someone's house. House, I think, is the structure, is the utilitarian purpose, but home is what you make it. Home is what you've put into it. that's kind of how culturally we perceive that. We're not walking into an empty house that we just bought and saying, this is my home. We say, this is my home in the sense that this will eventually be my home. So if we start looking at homes utilitarianly, we're looking at this dynamic space. It's, of course, a habitat for you. It holds your possessions. It holds your persons. It's where your family or your pets or your betta fish that you've set and you probably need to feed. And I would recommend getting an automatic feeder for your betta fish. It's from personal experience. It's decorated and spatially designed for you, particularly in your interior, as well as your exterior. I have a backyard that's kind of like a little living space. I have a little couch and a patio, and I like to sit out there when it's not 90 degrees. This will eventually be my home. But if we look at the difference between house and home and separate that, house is this physical space. It is this chair that you're sitting in. It is the objectification of your habitat. It's impersonal. It is utilitarian in that nature. So let's kind of go back in the history of when people started to recognize homes. So one of the first studied versions of what a home or a house was in an anthropological sense was medieval times, these houses that people lived in. If we think about Game of Thrones, we think about House Lannister and House Targaryen. If we look at Romeo and Juliet, it's a battle between these two houses, and they have a rivalry, and it's been there for ages and ages. It's the stuff that you still see in movies and in media today. In 1983, Claude Levi Strauss wrote on house societies. And he defined them as societies where elite power was organized via the institution of often noble houses, which bundled together family descent, land, power, and wealth. Levi Strauss argued that noble houses played a critical role in sustaining society by encompassing forms of power that might otherwise be tension. For instance, marriages within noble houses turned allies into kin, reconciling the tension that might have existed between maintaining distinct family groups and interest and the desire to build cross-cutting alliances. So the families in Romeo and Juliet are trying to stop this romance because they don't want to be joined in that house. You see that in the West Virginia famous story of the Hatfields and McCoys. You don't want to see them come together as a family because there will still be tension even if that happens. They haven't necessarily collectively agreed to marriage. Times like that have certainly changed, but as they say, back in the day, that used to be the case. In 1992, Pierre Bourdieu wrote this essay about the Berber people, which were a group living in the Atlas Mountains, how they had their houses and how they viewed the world. The cable people had distinctions in their home, not only shaped by public conduct and religious belief, but were manifest in the very layout, furnishings, and domestic routines. The physical organization of the cable house not only reflected the structure worldview, but was also responsible for reproducing it. Once this study was published, anthropologists began to focus on the home itself, and it was largely through physical houses. So your house is tailored to you, or you are working to get it to be the best possible way. If you own a home or are in an apartment, it's a never-ending situation in which you are buying some local art, you're finally putting in that couch that you wanted in your living room, you're looking at nice carpets, or maybe you're looking through the Amazon basics because sometimes simplicity is the best form of representation. But there are common properties in people's homes, and I want to go into some of them. The first one I want to talk about is hearth. The hearth is known as the center of the house. It's a place where the family meets, where food is prepared, and where kinship is made through transformation and sharing of substances. they're often the symbolic focus of the house. So your hearth would be more representative of your family or you than other parts of your house. When I think about how kitchens are laid out, generally, for the most part, I've seen them back away from the door. You enter the door and you either have a living room or a foyer or something of that nature. Things tend to be more personal as you progress back into an apartment or a room or a house. We often say home is where the heart is, but we often don't think where is the heart of the home. That's some grandpa wisdom for you, even though I'm not a grandpa. Another thing that we often say is this house has good bones. What are bones of the house? A phrase that people used to say is grow bones when couples would marry and move into houses. So when a house has good bones, that means that the house has been taken care of by a family that has put time and effort into maintaining it. Or it could be a singular person that has the affinity for maintaining and improving the house. Oftentimes, if we move into older houses, we often talk about how much personality it has. This is a side effect of what good bones are. There are often social constructs within homes. So homes are areas of social interaction and mediation. Nearly everyone is fought with their family, and this is why a lot of people fear a Thanksgiving table, I suppose. There's also smaller ones like, please put a coaster under your drink, or please don't put your feet up on the table, or make sure to feed the dogs at 6:30. There are ways of going about life that you'll conform to when you live within someone's home. So let's think about a modern context. How do we make a home? There's a contrast between a physical house and a subjective sense of home. However, it's not a solid one. Instead, as we work on the materiality of home, it's shown houses are often made into homes through the reworking of material forms. So renovation, decoration, furnishing are examples. I like to buy artwork. I like to go and I'll see a piece of furniture in an antique store and I'll want to get that. Or maybe I want to repaint from a very pale yellow to a very soft white. These help transform houses from generic expressions of familiar forms into places which tell the story of distinct personal lives and relationships. So let's go big picture here. Have you ever thought that you felt at home within a city or within a coffee shop or within a street that you like to go to concerts or go sit at the outside bar at? Well, that's a great form of home that is really being explored as people tend to urbanize here in the 21st century. So a lot of people have this sense of place with New York or San Diego, where they feel like that they have put in effort into building their community and collectively made a home with people that have shared values. You see that in cities, but you also see that in rural areas. You see that in people that have ancient family homes and land that they know the layout of, that they can walk through the forest and never be lost. There is an incomprehensible amount of area that could be considered your home. We often say that a country is our home. That's our home country, because living in that country, you often share values with the people that live there. I often think about this in where I live in Charleston. There's a lot of public art that's going up that I'm really in support of. There is a revamp of how we look at transportation. There's a preservation of these old historic neighborhoods that I am invested in. There is this movement of bringing music and culture and small businesses like the mom and pop pizzeria down the street that I love and invest my time into supporting. This feels like my home. While we're feeling comfortable here at home, let's take a break and hear from some sponsors.
Hey, Hello.
Hi.
Do you like bad movies?
Do you find yourself defending bad movies, saying things like, well, the soundtrack was okay, or the costumes were pretty fun?
From the previous hosts of It's Not That Bad podcast, we bring you Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast, from Simone LaRue and Chad Ekovitz.
Every week, we review two movies that did not do well critically, but we say, hey, there are some nice things about them. Maybe Rotten Tomatoes was wrong.
Maybe they're all fools, and you should watch these movies regardless. We'll also talk about scenes that could have saved it, and we'll often refer to Simone's cats because they're amazing and adorable, and we love them.
And at the end of each review, we will tell you whether we would watch this movie again, or in what circumstances we would recommend you watch this movie.
So, join us on July 9th for the first drop of our main episode, and then 2 days later for our drop of our minisodes.
And on Robots Radio, Podcast Network. Come see us on July 9th. We love you so much already. Bye!
Today we're talking about your camp. Now, former Vault resident, or someone who killed a Vault resident, let's start off with the basics, placing your camp. When plunking down your camp, C-A-M-P, that's an acronym, for the first time, remember to...
So we've heard some anthropology, let's get back to Fallout here. When I think about Holmes and Fallout, they are so entwined in 76 because of the camp feature. So camp, and like everything in Fallout, has a fun little acronym. It's the Construction and Assembly Mobile Platform. I'm sure that they were very happy when they came up with such an acronym. Essentially, what this item does, it allows you to place a camp nearly everywhere within the world that you explore within the game. There are some locations you can't directly place them in predetermined locations, like you can't do it in the middle of the city, but there's a lot of open area and even some faintly occupied area that you can put your camp within. Once you place it, you can start building. You collect resources throughout the game. You're constantly scavenging. This is a post-apocalyptic game where you are looking for wood and steel and breaking down things. And even early in the game, you're taking every gun and you're scrapping it off for parts so that you can build new weapons, armor, and stuff in your camp. It's in the core of the game's quest. Players are deemed with the responsibility of reclaiming America, and camps are the tool that they will use to build houses, workshops, and hangout spaces for all of the other people that are involved with it. Within the game, your camp evolves over time. So generally, if you're a level 1 to 20, your camp is pretty small. Maybe it's got one room and a door. You've taken some time to build your necessary workstations. You're generally in a lower level area. You're really just trying to keep this built, trying to keep it as a base. You're moving it more often. At a low level, fast travel within the game can be expensive, so you're most likely hoofing it to these different areas. There's kind of a cycle that tends to start with Fallout 76 where you will go out and do a quest or go to a location and finish and then think about how you're going to get back to your camp so you can drop off all of the stuff that you've collected. It's almost an adventure sense where you start at the tavern and you go out on your quest and you come back from your quest and you have yourself a mug of mead. That's what I imagine people drink in taverns. As you get into higher levels, your trophies and achievements within the game come in the form of camp items. You're starting to get mounted heads of animals that you've hunted or kinds of technology that you have found within the game itself. Slowly over time, you've picked a spot that you are partial to that becomes your spot for your camp. And then your camp becomes personal to you. It starts being your place of rest. It starts being a reflection of you. It's, even in this game, more of a reflection of your own interest within the Fallout world than how your character looks. Then there's almost this newer level of how people treat camps. I think that the developers were originally thinking that there was going to be a lot of PvP, and they've gone so much as saying that, but really there's been this community that's come out that is trying to help other players and be social in that setting. So camps have evolved to equip themselves for the social nature of players within the game. So when normally you would have a station that would be purifying water locked so that only you could get it, you would leave it unlocked so other people would get it. Same goes for other resources that you could collect. Then there is a separate I guess, negative to that, where people are making what they call trap camps, which find the fun in trapping other people within their design. To me, both of these are indicative of the evolution of the system. You start to notice the interests of other people, so other people like to make camps that are fit to the world, that look like something that you could find and stumble upon when you're playing the game naturally. Others like to do these wildly extravagant, bougie builds where they have these fancy statues and wallpaper, and it's almost like you're at a deluxe resort. Some are cold and unassuming and are filled with massive amounts of water purifiers and have stairs that float up above the ground, so they really don't need to, when they replace their camp, place it in an area where they can build it very easily. Then there's wildly creative builds that are a maze for a deathclaw or a meat grinder. A lot of people have been into Animal Crossing recently, and I almost feel like that Fallout 76 takes a lot of what was popular about that series and puts it within this role-playing RPG post-apocalyptic world where you were showing off your latest edition of maybe you have discovered a new type of plant that you have found the plans for and you want to show that off to your friends, or you have completed a special event and have gotten a fancy rug. That becomes a part of your story. It becomes something that you're showing off to all of your people. It becomes a social experience where you almost are trying to garner a general liking of what you have built within the game. Camps become home. They become emotional. You feel connected to things. And even if you rebuild and remodel, you keep some of your favorite things. You keep how you lay out your bar, or you keep how you lay out your room, but maybe you change this and that. As you get more things, maybe your wallpaper changes. Maybe your distribution and layout of where different things are changes. But you carry these things through the iterative progress, and you're most likely taking pictures of it along the way.
Guess I should have specified how I would have liked this to be resolved. I suppose it's on both our heads to find this treasure then. But you did good. Shows maybe you could be trusted. Maybe. But there's still the issue of my missing muscle.
I want to go into characters now and really talk about two characters. The first one is Duchess. So, who exactly is Duchess? We've really only been formally introduced to Duchess in the post-launch update called Wastelanders. She owns the Wayward, which is an inn and a bar that you first run into when you leave the vault, and that's how you start the new content. But if we go back and look at her story, you could even find that within the base game of 76 by going to the town of Welch and discovering a safe and some notes and learning that this character Duchess was originally this gigantic drug kingpin for Welch. She ends up running in competition to another drug operation and works with the government to escape the area and keep her operation on top, even by the time the war happens that the whole world gets bombed. Duchess eventually returns and opens up this bar, which the player first visits and does quest lines through her, which I won't spoil here. But there's some extra dialogue that you can learn about if you have found the notes and discovered the stories of Welch. So what's Duchess's relationship with her home? When I think about it in a modern context, historically, Welch is a post-mining economy that really has been crippled by people extracting the resources and then leaving and coming back and forth. There's no stable job. And modernly, within my time, there's a good amount of drug addiction issues within Welch and around West Virginia because of the economy, which is no surprise that there is a drug kingpin within Welch within the game. I've never really had to empathize with these very violent and predatory drug dealers, but oftentimes these people are a product of their environment. I think that Duchess has survived and feels like that she has wronged her home. This is where she grew up. This is where her history is, and she has not helped the end of the world has come and she has not done anything to progress the people. Duchess still holds a nonchalance about her, but it seems like that she secretly, in a hidden way, wants the best for people. I think this is her way of trying to make amends for what she has done. This is her restarting her own life.
Thank you. Really. It's good to have my Vault family around again. Anyway, I'm sure you must have other questions. We can talk about them now if you want. Or if you're ready to head out, just be careful out there.
Now let's talk about the Overseer of Vault 76, which was, I guess, the main character of the original base game and as a prominent character within the Wastelanders expansion. So the Overseer kind of has the most background of the characters because she grew up and lived in West Virginia before the war, and you can find her history all over. So she grew up the daughter of a coal miner and a teacher. Her mother ended up dying in a coal mining accident. She ended up falling in love with this guy that you can find out more about in the story. She ended up wanting to go to college and become a part of Vault Tech, which is a gigantic corporation that is trying to save people from the end of the world. And she felt moved by the values of that corporation itself. She felt a duty to use her skills to achieve the same goals that they were after. She eventually found that Vault Tech was doing some experiments, and that didn't sit well with her and kind of started those seeds of doubt. So she ended up moving from Vault 101, where she was going to be the Overseer, to Vault 76. Vault 101 is the vault from Fallout 3, and 76 is, of course, the one from the game I'm talking about. She fell into this position of Overseer and tried her best to prepare people in earnest for coming outside of the vault. But when she came out, she found that the world and her community and her fiancé had been destroyed or altered beyond recognition. I imagine that maybe she thought that things would be okay for them, that they would find a way. It would be hard, but they would come out of this vault and help these people rebuild. I think finding no people for her and then learning the stories of these groups of people demoralized her. I come to this conclusion because of a few things. First, the camp that she has taught you about, that you learn about, is so important to rebuilding the world, is left for you. She lays her camp down as a starting location and says she doesn't need it. She's abandoned her home for a greater purpose, but she has abandoned her home because she feels like her home has been destroyed. She feels like she's betrayed her family, and she feels like she's betrayed her own vault dwellers and failed them when they eventually got their hands on nuclear weapons and began using them for purposes that she did not want. The Overseer, I think, was blinded by the ambition and her vision of the future and really didn't understand the realities of the world. I think she feels she may have made the wrong decision by taking away valuable leadership from the people of her home state. The people within Vault 76 are considered to be the best of the best, and she continually talks about that. But without the best of the best, a lot of things tend to crumble over time due to these outrageous circumstances. I think the Overseer and Duchess are very similar in the regards that they have both lost their home place, and they believe that it's their own negligence that has had a major effect on the outcome. The truth is, there's a grander issue at stake, but you can lose your home. You can, of course, have your house burned down or have something happen to your house, but your home remains, but your sense of home, you can lose that. Oftentimes, we feel personally responsible for that feeling. We feel like that it's something that we've done, but most of the time, it's factors beyond our control that have caused that sense. There are real things that destroyed Appalachia, which is what they consider their home and what is our home collectively as players within the game. So, for example, the Brotherhood of Steel couldn't work with the responders and the Free States and couldn't end this scorched plague. previously wealthy raiders destroyed communities because they were essentially resource deficient because of their distance from main hubs. Corporations also destroyed the landscape for a greater yield of resources, and a lot of the environments within the game aren't due to the bombs dropping. It's due to a lot of the negligence that these resource extraction companies have had on the area. You're often tasked with saving Appalachia, but you can't save it how it was. People have already lost. The story of the game itself is continually being written, and progressively, instead of saving it, we're remaking it to be more livable, to have people have connections and settlements, as we've seen with Wastelanders and eventual updates when the Brotherhood of Steel will return. The game itself was in a sorry state when it released, but there's this community that plays and creates and shares Fallout 76. They have banded together to keep this game more than alive and really pushing the meter on what a multiplayer experience can look like. And it's towards the optimistic end in ways that I don't think that the company Bethesda has considered before. This lends the question back on reality. I think a lot of people, as they grow up, feel that they've lost their sense of home. Of course, they say home is wherever your family is, and I think that's true. But the combination of space and emotion may be gone. I hope that you haven't lost your home place or are working to make your home place, but for those that have, I can't offer any solid advice. I really can only speak from my personal experience within Appalachia. As I said before, all I wanted to do as a kid was leave the place that I grew up. There was always something special, I think, about returning home when I was in college and when I first moved out, and seeing the beauty of the landscape, seeing these mountains driving along the highway. As a kid, I would remark that summer is not fully here until we see green at the top of the mountain. So that means that the leaves have grown in on these very tall mountains. I remember driving in the car one day and pulling up and seeing the entire side of the mountain had had its trees cut down. It looked like wreckage. It looked like not a fire, but just a gigantic blade had scraped across the side of the mountain, and it made me feel sad. There's a lot of systems in place that have taken away a lot of the culture in Appalachia that you see in the game represented, but in the communities now, there's so much that we have left behind. My philosophy is that we can't reclaim what's been lost. We have to face these issues, but there's no way of going back to the way things were. The mom-and-pop shops have been torn down to place Walmarts and commercial properties that are agnostic to the culture of our region. The advice that I'm trying myself to follow is not look back on the past, but take what's still there, combine it with what I want, and make a new sense of home. That's why Charleston is so special to me. It's not the town that I grew up in. It's this city that has had hard times but is growing in its own ways. This is where I've laid down my roots and am building a home for myself with my wife and my dogs. Home place is about ownership. It's not about your control of the situation. It's about your ownership and your partnership with the people that make your home. Thank you for listening to the first episode of Geography Arcade. It was such a joy to begin podcasting again. Every week we're going to come out with a new episode. This one is particularly bittersweet, but we're not going to just be doing Fallout stuff. We've got a ton of video games and stuff coming for you later on. If you want to engage more with the community, and in the next episode we'll have some community engagement segments, you can go to our Discord, which is in the link in the show notes down below, and interact with our community. If you want to send an email to the show, email us at thegeographyarcade at gmail.com. You can also follow us on social media at geographyarcade. If you're into Fallout and you want to hear more, guess what? I do a weekly show called The Fallout Hub with my hosts, Ken and Tom, where we talk about all the Fallout goodness, not necessarily in this anthropological sense, but good nonetheless. I've also started a Patreon for Geography Arcade that allows you to help support the show. We're doing a monthly Patreon episode of the show. We're still getting the details together about that, but any support that you can give would be fantastic to the development of the show. I hope you all are staying safe and are doing your best at home. Now is a great time to appreciate the things that we've put into making our homes. I hope to see you next week as we talk a little bit about pocket monsters. Have a great week.
Rated M for mature.
Because we don't believe in scripted advertisements, we're gonna do this raw.
I'm regretting this decision.
No, you're not. This is the DL, Weekly Gaming News. There's nothing to regret here, because it's your source for everything in the gaming world. Every week, we bring it to you. Unscripted. Unfiltered. That's why it's rated M for mature, right, Brenna?
Among many, many other reasons.
I am one of your hosts, Jameson.
And as he already said, I am Brenna, the other glorious part to this quality podcast.
You can find us every week wherever you listen to your podcasts at DL Gaming News. And you can also find us on Instagram and Twitter if you want some gaming news in your social media feed every day at DL Gaming News.
And you can find us individually if you really, really, truly want to see our faces. I am at DL underscore Mother Goose.
And I'm at DL Jameson. And this was an advertisement. Go fuck yourselves.
Have you ever wondered how deep the Elder Scrolls lore rabbit hole goes? Have you got a grasp of the basics and want to find out more about the universe? Written in Uncertainty is here to help you. We'll be mixing in philosophy, theology, and whatever other theory is useful with Elder Scrolls texts to untangle some of the biggest questions in the series, like what are Dragonbreaks, how does Chim work, where did the Dwemer go, and more. Check us out at writteninuncertainty.com or find Written in Uncertainty on any podcatcher. Thanks for listening, and catch you later in the grey maybe of Tamriel.
This episode is brought to you by Gamefly. Gamefly is the video game rental service that they send you games every month if you're subscribed to their service, and it could be new games. It could be stuff like the new Crash Bandicoot. It could be Marvel's Avengers. It could be older games. You never know. Here's what I would recommend. I would recommend you get some Nintendo games because the Switch has very low memory and the cartridges are pretty good. And then it saves all your save data, so if you like it, you can go buy it once you're done. The offer I have for you today is 60 days for $10. That's 60 days for $10. Essentially, that's just 30 free days. So go ahead, go down to the link in the description, check out the offer from Gamefly. That's the ad.